Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is Tony, and you are listening to Tales from the Count Zone, Episode 5. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you, and I hope everybody else is.
Yes, funny you should bring that up, because in case people who follow the show didn't notice, we didn't put up a show last week. Now, there's a reason for that. I had a bit of a medical emergency. I thought I was dying. So, you know, we like to have this show come out whenever we can, as soon as, you know, we want to make this a weekly thing. So for us to take the week off, it's like it had to be a medical emergency of some kind for especially me who likes doing these kind of shows to get me away from the microphone. So for that, I apologize to the audience. It's like, you know, I barring a medical emergency, nothing's going to stop me from doing this show. But considering last week, that's what happened to me. That's why there was no show last week.
Yeah, I mean we have basically fitted into a routine now that we always record this on a Sunday. Well, for me, it's the Sunday evening. I guess for you, it's a Sunday.
Afternoon.
It's afternoon.
It's 12:08 right now.
Oh, okay. But yeah, we always, if anyone ever sort of wonders, because sometimes we talk about the actual day of it. It's always a Sunday when we record these things.
Yeah, because sometimes Coughlin will decide to let it go up on a Monday or a Tuesday. So sometimes there's no making heads or tails of when this goes up. Sometimes it's whenever I decide to post it, but sometimes Coughlin has strategic posting. So we there's no definite day that this show goes up, but it does go up in sometime this week. So for us to miss a week, that's something I feel like I need to explain. Okay. With that out of the way, let's go into this week's news, which since I took the week off, we're kind of playing a little bit of catch up. And our first news story is Captain America spoiler thoughts.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we've both, by now we have both seen the film. I've seen it twice. Have you seen it twice?
Yes, I've seen it twice. Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah. I hate watching films more than once. I'm a guy, if I watch a film once, I never want to see it again, at least not in the theaters. Maybe when it comes out on DVD, Blu-ray, or when it's shown on TV, I don't mind watching it again. I'm a guy who hates watching films more than once. But with Captain America Civil War, I couldn't wait to watch it by myself. And then when my buddy says, hey, I want to watch the film too, he's like, unless you haven't seen the film. And I specifically told him, like I just mentioned, I don't like watching films the second time. This is the exception. So good. I would go as far to say a 5-star film.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I honestly saw, you know, very little wrong with it. There were a few little things that I felt just really sort of minor little points which sort of, you know, I can see why it didn't happen. I mean, for example, one of the things that I kind of would have liked would be, it was the whole conflict with Captain the Accords. It was very much sort of like a what if type thing. It is opposition to them. Mm-hmm. So it was like, you know, what if we're sent somewhere where we don't want to go? What if we're not allowed to go somewhere we don't? It was all very much, I would have maybe liked to have seen something that was showed something a little more concrete that he said, you know, no, that's wrong. We're not doing that. But then again, with the amount of time that the movie took anyway, that would probably have, you know, it took a really long time to actually get in there. You know, but just sort of something like that, just something a little bit more concrete of sort of his reservations. But, overall, you know, I said this before I did the non-spoiler reviews. It's, and now I've seen it twice, I think I can honestly say that this is my favorite Marvel movie. I'm not saying it's necessarily the best or like a better movie film than say Winter Soldier, but for the one that I think I will sort of like, you know, get the most enjoyment with and watch time and time again, you know, this is the one that I sort of, you know, enjoy the most. You know, there was so many good things about it. I mean, of course, the airport scene. Just, I mean, that thing went for like, you know, nearly 20 minutes. You know, and actually mingle at 20 minutes, and it just didn't feel like it just flew by, and it was just so amazingly entertaining and gripping at the same time. And, you know, and just sort of, you know, just an amazing film. And then, you know, just the whole story, like, what I liked about it is there was so much, everyone had like a motivation for what they were doing. You know, mm-hmm. Cap had a point of view, what he was doing, you know, Tony. I mean, the Tony Stark thing, you can actually follow a lot of the thing that drove him in this film from stuff that's happened in the other movies. Mm-hmm. You know, this wasn't just a thing where he sort of like suddenly became, oh no, we need regulations. If you look, all the things that he's done from the time when he's sort of, you know, his bombs were being used to sort of, you know, in wars and getting people killed and stuff. And then his sort of, his whole thing with Ultron that all, you know, all went pear-shaped and everything. You can see like a steady progression. You can sort of, you know, trace this back. So it was just, you know, just done so, you know, so very well. And even like the new characters, I mean, obviously Spider-Man, you know, was awesome. He only had like a few scenes, but it was great in it and really entertaining, the fight scene. But Black Panther as well, you know, who I thought maybe, you know, with Spider-Man coming in, I thought Spider-Man was going to sort of steal his storyline somewhat. And the Black Panther storyline didn't go quite how I expected it to do. But I thought that whole storyline was amazing. And it was a good contrast as well, because his sort of storyline was similar in a way to like Tony Stark's, and the fact that he sort of like, you know, he felt he'd lost his sort of like, you know, his father to the Winter Soldier. It turned out that he, as Tony Stark actually did do that. And just sort of the way that the two of them sort of like, you know, reacted to that. I just thought there was just so much really, really good stuff in there.
Yeah. As far as, you know, you brought up earlier when you first started talking about the film, It's a fantastic film. It's probably one of your favorites. And if we have any criticism of the film, it's really just nitpicking and stuff. I'm sort of right there with you. There's stuff I had problems with the film, but with that said, they were all nitpick stuff. Like I thought the choosing of, I think Spider-Man was maybe perhaps a little bit too young when you consider the age of just about everybody else on the team. It's one of those things to where once Spider-Man gets to the age where most people, you know, when they think of Spider-Man, they think of that appropriate age. It's like, well, then all the superheroes are going to be older. And it kind of throws off the dynamic, at least in my opinion. And then, like I said, the airport scene I thought was fantastic. I think that made the film. Because when you saw those previews, you naturally just assumed it was going to be a short, quick battle, maybe 10, 15 minutes tops. But that thing went on for like 20, 25 minutes, almost 30 minutes, and it was fantastic. I wasn't complaining about the length. If anything, my only real criticism of the airport scene is maybe they should have left that scene for maybe later on in the film, because I felt like that was the peak of the film. The final scene between Cap and Iron Man, that was great and all, and that was a great climax to the film, but I just felt like the film's peak was, in fact, that great fight scene in the airport.
Yeah, one of the things that sort of I really loved about this film, and this sort of ties in, what you've just said, ties into it a little bit, is it did away with the Marvel formula that you have in a lot of their movies, where it's very much that the final battle is normally, okay, this is like the alien or robot force or the big bad guy or whatever. To be this guy, we've got to shoot him here or put a disc in this or, you know, turn this switch off. So it's always something like that. It's always like, you know, like shooting the hole on the Death Star. But it's always that sort of like, you know, little bit where this one didn't end that way. This one was like just a really personal battle, you know, at the end of sort of emotion. And that's what I really, really liked about this, because I felt was like it'd been a bit of a tease and a swerve towards the end, because they had this storyline with the super soldiers and Zemo basically going to like reawaken the super soldiers. And I sort of started to think, well, it's going to be one of those like classic Marvel team-ups that they've been doing since basically Stan Lee basically started doing comics, where you have two heroes fight and then sometimes with a misunderstanding, and then you have the big threat come along, but both of them team up and put aside the differences and they, you know, defeat the bad guys and everything. And they didn't do that. No. They teased, because I thought this is what's going to be, that, you know, the three of them are going to team up against the super soldiers and that's going to be the thing that sort of brings them back together. And they didn't do that. They sort of, you know, they did away with the super soldiers, and then they had the big revelation about sort of that Winter Soldier had killed Stark's parents. And that basically, you know, that basically then made it a very personal fight. The fight at the airport was basically, you know, the fight for sort of like, you know, basically, almost, you know, the fight of sort of, you know, doing the thing of the law. So bringing in, you know, Tony trying to, you know, bring in the, you know, the renegade Avengers and capture them and sort of, you know, in, you know, to go along with the Accords. The fight at the end was basically just like a really personal, issue, like, you know, a revenge story. And actually, like that, it was different to what they've done with a lot of the, you know, what they've done, with, you know, regularly with the sort of, with the Marvel movies. So I, so, you know, so I really sort of, I really like the battle at the end because of that sort of thing. And also, a lot of people be sort of going on about, Zemo was, you know, saying he was disappointed and everything. But what I like about this guy is that basically he had a motivation as well, which was, beyond sort of it, he wanted to destroy the world. He basically just wanted to take down the Avengers and a good reason for doing that. Mm-hmm. But also at the end, that sort of scene where we sort of like, you know, in, you know, the Marty Freeman character saying to him, like, you know, you know, how does it feel that you failed, you know, but after all this effort? And he just sort of looks and he goes, did I? Because of all the sort of villains in Marvel, he's the only one that's actually, you know, succeeded in what he wanted to do.
Well, I wouldn't say all not succeeded, because I'm sure his main goal would have been, I'm sure his main goal would have been either one of them kill each other.
Well, yeah, I guess.
Like really, his, part of his plan obviously was to break them up, but obviously his end goal was to either have them all die or have them, have Cap kill Iron Man or Iron Man kill Cap. So in that sense, he kind of failed, but yeah, his overall plan, I guess, sort of was just to break up the Avengers. So to which I say that was kind of cool, and he sort of did succeed in that.
Yeah. The one thing I would say, because from here on, we're basically going into the Infinity Wars. I hope we don't just basically forget about the Accords. I'm kind of a little disappointed that we basically the next storyline is going towards like the Thanos storyline.
Yeah, I feel like we need a buffer, because I think the way we're leaving off right now, it's fine and all, but I don't understand how you go from a story like this. And we've seen the chart, the schedule for films that they have planned. The next film in this, I guess you would say, saga of these the Avengers would be them fighting Thanos. And it's like, it's really, and I'm glad they're taking their time. They're going to do the Tomb film idea, because it's going to be so hard to just, you're going to do a complete 180. You're going from this gritty, realistic story. You're going to go this guy from space decides to invade the Earth. So it's like, I don't know.
I don't know. I'd maybe like to have another film where we've got Cap and his team as like renegade Avengers and on the run. Mm-hmm. You know, and have sort of like a down-to-earth sort of stuff, and have sort of more of the Accords, because the Accords haven't basically gone away. I'd like to see a film where it basically there's more to do with the Accords, and maybe have the Accords getting more and more like restrictive and out of hand. So, you know, maybe that sort of, you know, like in the Civil War comic, where basically Tony's having to basically like round up the sort of the vigilante type heroes and stuff, and it's sort of, you know, not so much a Civil War too, but just sort of deal with that somewhat, you know what I mean? Whereas, I mean, the thing is, we've got like two films to do the Infinity War, so maybe we'll see some of that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I'm glad that they're taking their time and doing the two film idea, because first when I saw it on paper, I just assumed it was a cash grab. They wanted to tell this one story with this film, but they realized it was going to be so expensive that they needed to split it into two films so they can kind of get the money that they would get from two films as opposed to one, which I sort of understand, but at this point, you kind of do need the two films, because you really can't go from where they left off in Civil War to go straight to whatever. If they decide to, you know, like I said, we don't know for sure. They're choosing to call it Infinity War, so who's to say if it's going to be based off of Infinity Gauntlet? All signs seem to point in that direction, but nothing's set in stone. So you kind of do need a bit of a buffer to go from gritty, realistic Civil War story where the superheroes are at each other's throats to them either in space or they're fighting this guy who's invading Earth from space. So you kind of do need that buffer, and I think that's what we're going to get. And to be honest, the Infinity Gauntlet story, it's not like it's a long, intricate story where you do need the two films to retell the entire story. No, it's in fact a very short story. So the idea of them using the first film to set up all the stuff that would be sort of a representation or a retelling of the Infinity Gauntlet story in the second film, I'm sort of glad with, because you do sort of need that film to kind of, I guess you would say, set the table. Because we've also seen the people that they have planned cast for this film. It's pretty much just everyone that they've established so far in all their continuities, whether it be film or TV. They're all going to bring them under one roof. So to do something like that, I kind of feel like you do need a film to set that up. So I'm kind of glad they're taking their time.
Yep, definitely. And apparently, Captain Marvel is going to be in it as well. That's where we're going to debut her.
Well, it's funny they keep leaking all these names, but I'm like, if you can put two and two together, they keep leaking all these names. It's just, well, everyone's going to be in the film.
Yeah.
Like, you could say, oh, Captain Marvel's going to be in the film. It's like, well, I kind of figured that when you mentioned all these other names are going to be in the film. I'm sure the Guardians, have they announced them formally that they're going to be in the film? I have to imagine they're going to.
They haven't announced it, no.
But you have to imagine. But, like, this is the end game in all this, right?
Well, I would imagine that the Guardians of Galaxy 2, which comes out before Infinity War, that's going to play a part. Mm-hmm. In sort of setting the stage for Infinity War. If Infinity War is going to, obviously, you would think is going to be Thanos and everything. You would think that basically the film which would sort of like, you know, start to set the seeds for that and basically sort of like, you know, set the stage would be Guardians of the Galaxy, because that's basically their,
that's their MO, yeah.
That's their MO, you know. I would imagine that it's, there'll be an after credit scene, or maybe the scene ends in Guardians of the Galaxy where basically Star-Lord says, you know, we need to return to Earth.
Yeah, something to that equivalent would be kind of cool.
Yeah. So that's, I would imagine that, you know, that they will be, you know, in there, which when you think about it, that would be awesome. Cause you think like you've got sort of Star-Lord, maybe, wisecracking with Tony Stark and stuff, and like, you know, and Rocket Raccoon and everything like that. But there's just so much, you know, stuff they couldn't get out of all this.
Yeah, so they set up the table, and I'm kind of glad we're getting that buffer film. But with the takeaway, I guess, from this entire discussion real quick is with all of its flaws, which, you know, are very minuscule. And like I said, we're sort of skewering the film, but really at this point it's just nitpicking. Just the stuff that maybe we would have done differently. But really, at the end of the day, I thought it was a 5-star film.
Yeah.
I sort of agree with you there. It's probably the best film they've done at this point. I don't know if that's a definite statement. Maybe I'd have to go back and rewatch the films. But I can't think of it. I can't think of Winter Soldier being better than this film in my mind. So I'm probably going to agree with you right there. This is probably the best film that Marvel's done so far.
Yeah. I mean, just to put this into cold hard cash, it's already took more money than Batman v Superman. it's on its way. I mean, looking at the figures, it's sort of doing just slightly under what Age of Ultron was doing. Mm-hmm. You know, and doing more above, it's doing better than Iron Man 3. Just to give you an idea, Iron Man 3, I think, finished on about 1,200,000,000. Age of Ultron was 1,400,000,000. So I think it's going to go in between that. I have to say as well, this one really has grasped people's imaginations, because there are people who I know and friends of mine who basically don't normally make a big thing of going to see these films. They'll wait until it comes out on DVD or over and over. But the amount of people who have said to me, oh, I'm seeing Civil War tonight, who don't normally go to these films, you know, and people who I know on Facebook and stuff who aren't really into them, who are basically sort of, you know, getting in touch with me saying, oh, we're going to see Civil War. It's funny as well, we all say, we don't say Captain America 3, we all say Civil War. You know, this one's really sort of like, you know, and most people who I know afterwards, basically, they say, I say, what did you think? And there's been one person so far who didn't like it, but she's a bit weird anyway. Everybody else, they just sort of look at me and go, loved it. And it's like, people are, you know, this one's going to have legs because of the word of mouth is so strong. And, you know, people are absolutely, you know, loving this film.
Yeah. There's not much to complain on this film.
No.
Okay. From there, we're going to go to sort of, as long as we're talking all things Disney properties, let's see if I can pronounce this right, Dazza. Correct me if I'm saying it wrong. Eden Heidenreich?
That's as close as I can get as well. I have to admit, I have been sort of like practicing that, trying to say that, because it's quite difficult. Eden Heidenreich, I believe is how it's pronounced. And he's basically been cast as the young Han Solo.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've only really seen him in one film, which was Hail Caesar a few months ago I saw. And I think this is a good choice because he was great in that.
Okay.
I mean, Hail Caesar, I personally, like, you know, really enjoyed his film. That had a hell of a cast. And he basically held his own in that film. And there was a few scenes that he stole. Basically, he plays like a Western actor who's trying to go into serious movies, and he's basically out of in depth. And there's one scene that he did where he's absolutely hilarious, where he's trying to do his serious scenes and do his lines right, and he just keeps getting them wrong. And for an actor to actually play being a bad actor and be, you know, and pull it off convincingly is something which I think is quite difficult. He does it well, and he's really funny, but he's also, he was in another film called Beautiful Creatures, which I've not seen, but I've seen it. I clicked on a few clips on it just to see what it's like. And I think he's a real good choice. He's got that sort of like Harrison Ford, suave about him. And he's got that sort of like that thing where he's good looking, but not good looking in a way that he's sort of puts off like, male viewers. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's not a pretty boy.
No, he's kind of got like a roguish dashingness to him, I think. And I think he basically, you know, will make a really good young Han Solo, providing he doesn't try to basically, they don't have him do like an impersonation of Harrison Ford. If he just sort of, but I think if he does what, I forgot his name. Is it Chris Pine who's in, the Star Trek films? Who plays with Neil Captain Kirk? It's not Chris Pine.
Let me investigate this right now. The same sounds familiar, but I sort of see what you're getting at.
Yeah.
You were correct. It's Chris Pine.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Who, you know, basically bringing his own, you know, thing to the character. So, which I've, you know, hopefully we'll be able to do. But yeah, I think this, you know, this will be, you know, a real good. I think as well, one of the good things about it is, even though I've seen him in Hail Caesar, he's not like an actual megastar at the moment. So he's sort of, you know, there's a lot to come from him. He's not basically, you know, he's like a, we've a lot to learn about him as an actor and everything. And I think that's, you know, that's good that we're not coming there with a preconceived notion of sort of like who he is. It's not like if we were getting like a young Tom Cruise or something like that, you know, we've got like sort of like a, you know, not quite an unknown actor, but like sort of like, you know, when, you know, he's not a superstar at this moment, which I think is going to be good for the role. Bit like, you know, Daisy Ridley in his Force Awakens is what I'm mumbling and trying to get out, basically.
You're doing just fine, Daz. In fact, more often than not, you tend to be better than me. But I sort of see what you're saying here. And we've seen this before, the people that Disney casts, they always like to go with these unknown actors, mainly because they probably come cheap. Because,
well,
I think it's more so they come cheap because A, they don't have to pay them much because they're not a big name, but then B, they can say, oh, we shouldn't have to pay you that much because we're going to put you in this fantastic film and we're going to make you a star. And then you can do these other films where you can negotiate to make more money. This is the film where you make a name for yourself. And then the other films is where you go make your money. So it's kind of sneaky and it's kind of shady from Disney to do stuff like this, to kind of pick unnamed actors because of reasons like this. But then also, you know, if they plan on doing a full line prequel series. And this is sort of piggybacking while we were doing the Marvel films earlier. It's easy to negotiate with someone like this. You get an X picture deal because you still have all the leverage. Where if you pick a big name actor or an up and coming actor, then they may be harder to negotiate with, ask more money. And when you're trying to do multiple pictures, it's kind of hard to do. So yeah, this actor is kind of out of nowhere. I've never really seen any most of his work. And I'm sure he's fantastic. And a film like this, they can cast almost whoever they want, unless barring that they choose someone who looks nothing like Han Solo. I think if you get a halfway decent, competent actor, they'll do a decent film. But I think the strength of this movie is probably going to have to come from the script. And that's sort of where I kind of want to move this discussion. How do you tell a Han Solo prequel story? I mean, there's, from what we've seen established so far, I don't know if Han Solo is a character that can carry an entire movie on himself. And maybe the idea is they're going to make a whole new supporting cast underneath Han Solo in this new prequel movie. But I'm just like, okay, I understand there's this great need to try to milk this Star Wars franchise. And they're sort of playing the experimental thing as we're seeing so far in Rogue One. But I just, I'm skeptical. I'm cautiously optimistic. I so far Disney's batting 1,000, so I don't question whether or not it'd be good. But I'm just like, you know, everybody doesn't need a film. Han Solo doesn't need a film necessarily. I don't think Princess Leia needs a film. I haven't seen anything definite, but I've seen rumblings on the internet about Boba Fett film. So I'm just like, they're these great characters and they're great as, you know, pieces in an overall big story, but I question whether or not they need an entire film based around them.
I think with Han Solo, you can get a lot out of it because you don't know anything before his sort of his life before the Star Wars New Hope. With the others, with Luke Skywalker, you've basically just got like years and years of farming. With Princess Leia, you've got all the basically growing up on Alderaan and being a senator. But with Han Solo, you've basically got a guy who became like sort of like one of the biggest criminals in the galaxy. Mm-hmm. So you've all that thing of how he basically became that. You can have him basically. I don't know. Just for example, you could have him basically like as a guy from a rich family that basically, you know, went his own way and became like a criminal, a smuggler and everything. You could have him that basically he fell in with the wrong people and basically had to grew up in jails and stuff like that. But there is a lot that you can get out of it. And it's also that side of Star Wars. I always think that if you ever read any of the novelizations or the expanded universe and that, there is so much more to the Star Wars universe than what we've seen. Cause we've always seen like sort of a bit the Jedi and the rebellion side. There's all the side, all the crime side that goes on, you know, like in the bar in the first hours, and then you've got the bounty hunters and so on. There's all that life that we've not actually seen. And there's also that one big storyline that they've alluded to, but you've obviously never seen, is basically how him and Chewbacca came together. Because in the Star Wars mythology, basically Chewbacca has a life debt to Han Solo.
Ah, okay.
Because Solo basically saved, and I don't know exactly where this actually first got. It might have actually come out in the Star Wars Holiday Special, believe it or not.
Is that canon now? Is that retrospect now that Disney's taken over the brand?
It could be. I mean, you know, it could be. We'll have to go back to revisit that one day, because that is hilarious. But one of the things that Han Solo apparently saved Chewbacca and his family from slavery. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of like a storyline that you could do, you know, you could go into that storyline and how basically him and Chewbacca, you know, became friends and everything. And I think there is just, you know, so much that you can basically do. Of all the characters, I think you're right, not everyone needs a character. I mean, when they said we were going to do a Yoda film, you know, that to me, you know, I have no interest in seeing a Yoda film at all. And most of the other characters, I'm not that interested in seeing like, a young face. I mean, think about it this way. You've got the whole Lando storyline as well, because there was always like a backstory that Lando was the one who had the Millennium Falcon and Solo managed to like con him out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go that direction. You can go in how he got the Millennium Falcon and all that. I think there's a lot that you can do with that character. I think the only two people, well, maybe three, because I think you could do a Boba Fett story because he's basically pretty much a blank slate as well. The only three that I think you could really do a Solo movie would be Solo, Boba Fett, and I think basically you could do a Western type film with Obi-Wan, with his life on Tatooine, you know, while he was basically overlooking Luke.
But I think that story is, he was laying low, so I don't know what stories you could tell there. I mean, obviously sort of what you were saying earlier, you brought up stuff with Lando. I feel like you could maybe make a buddy film with that. Obviously, you could maybe do it with Chewbacca, but I don't see you doing a buddy film with a character who, as far as the audience is concerned, can't talk. So I think you'd be better off if you want to tell sort of this. I don't even know what it'd be, but the first thing that pops in my mind is like a buddy film where it's just Han and Lando just, you know, just being scoundrels in the galaxy. That'd be kind of cool, but even still, I'd be like, we're talking about what, 120 minutes worth of story, and it's like, I don't know if it's really there. And then we've seen from the Star Wars comics since Marvel has taken over the helm of the comic books, they've done a storyline where Han has quote unquote got married. So maybe you could do something where you could maybe expand on that. What kind of deal were they doing where they had to do some kind of marriage ceremony where Han quote unquote got married? So, I mean, even still, I mean, you got somewhat resembling a film, a script. But then, well, I guess I trust Disney and their movie magic to maybe make it worth watching. But I'm just saying there's no gigantic outworld. There's no demand for this big Han Solo film. So I like I said, I'm cautiously optimistic, but like I said, Disney's batting 1,000, so it'll probably be pretty good when it's all said and done.
Yeah. I think you're underselling the Star Wars fandom, frankly.
I think that Rogue One film is going to be the real test of the franchise. Cause it's not like it's a numbered movie in the franchise. This is clearly and obviously an offshoot movie. So I'm curious to see what kind of numbers it'll do when the film finally comes out later on this year.
Yeah. I think you're underestimating it. The Star Wars fandom, it is bigger than Marvel's fandom. You know, I remember when they first started doing the novels, you know, way back in I think it was the early 90s when they first started doing the novels. Might have even been before then. And it was like there'd not been any new Star Wars material for like years and years ever since the Return of the Jedi. And when we started doing like, you know, the novels, they just all became like really big bestsellers. It was like, you know, and it's never even like, you know, gone close to going away. Even the prequels, which basically all sucked. You know, the last one wasn't so bad, but they all were bad. Even that couldn't kill it, you know. So I think there's more than enough room, and I think the Han Solo thing, but you know, there will be a massive interest in this.
Okay, so we'll agree to disagree now is concerned. Let's move on to our next story. Okay, this one I'm trying to take great pleasure in, but you know, it's clearly I'm being transparent here, but the poor Apocalypse reviews so far.
Yeah, they had the press reviews last week, and pretty universally, people aren't the ones I've seen. They're not out and out hating it, but they're saying that it is a disappointment. And the best reviews that I've seen are basically that the good outweighs the bad, but the bad basically brings the film down. And I have to say, I don't know if it's just because there's been so many sort of big comic book films this year, because I was like really, really hyped for or eager to see. You had Deadpool, you had Batman v Superman, and of course you got Civil War. Up to this X-Men Apocalypse film, even when the trailers were good, I've not been excited about it at all. There's just been something just sort of like missing. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's that we've seen most of the characters before. There's no one really new coming in, but it's not like based on an epic storyline.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm going to see it. I'm actually seeing it this Wednesday because we know as usual with
Marvel. You bastard.
I know. Yeah, this Wednesday I'm seeing it. Wednesday morning as well. I forgot the day off that day, so I've got an early morning showing. But I always try to see these films on the first day and stuff. But this one, it's just not sort of, it's just not gripping me. And these reviews are pretty much saying that the same thing. Jennifer Lawrence seems to be getting. I think this is one of the things that I've noticed about the trailer. And somebody mentioned that apparently it was something in her contract that she's not Mystique in most of the footage that I've seen for the trailers. In the original X-Men movies, in the original trilogy, she was basically Mystique. And when I say Mystique, I mean in the blue, sort of like, the blue skin and everything. Unless she was basically having to go undercover, or she was having to basically hide or fit in. But when she was basically on her own, she was Mystique. And here it seems to be that she's basically Jennifer Lawrence pretty much all the time.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things to where when they're sort of looking to maybe restart the franchise again, they cast Jennifer Lawrence, and they cast her as, I wouldn't say a complete unknown, but she wasn't what she would wind up becoming, this big, giant superstar A-lister. I think it's one of those things they just lucked into, and they instead of just running away from it and sort of dismissing her or even writing her off, I think they chose to run with her. Cause, you know, this is something that they've established earlier in the films, and they figured they need a big star, and who bigger than Jennifer Lawrence is someone they've already put in the films already. And I'm sure she didn't come cheap the second time around. But, yeah, I think it's one of those things to where she's the big star, even people who aren't necessarily interested in X-Men who are going to probably want to see it. And I think her alone is going to bring an X amount of business. And I think when you're dealing with a girl like her, even though her character is a certain way and really it doesn't make sense for her to be so much as the looking human with the blonde hair and whatnot, it's just one of those things that where it's the business side of it. It's like, who's going to pay to see a film with Jennifer Lawrence, the big A-list movie star, made up in blue makeup for, I would say, 90% of the film, where that's what you and I would expect as comic book readers or someone who's watched all the films prior to this. But you have to see things from the business side. I've even seen like some stories way back when where they would, I think this is part of the reason why they went with Iron Man the way they did. You'll see these superheroes, they'll be in the mask, but more often than not, they'll be without the mask. Because I think as far their, I guess it is their agent or whoever's managing their brand, it's like, okay, we're fine with you being the superhero movie. It's a big movie. Everyone's going to see it. But we really want to get you over. We want to get your face over. And we can't do that with you, and especially in this with the example of Iron Man, behind a metal plate. So I think that's sort of what they went with, you know, sort of you can see within the suit. You can see Robert Downey Jr.'s face. I think that's why they chose to do stuff like that. So to sort of go back to our X-Men argument, that's why they chose to have Jennifer Lawrence the way she is as Mystique, to have her so much made up like a human. Because when you're paying Jennifer Lawrence all that money, you want to advertise Jennifer Lawrence is in the film, and you want to try to have her as human as possible, because it's easier to put her on a poster, but if you have her all made up in blue makeup, it's like, what are you paying for then?
I wondered if it cost she hated being in the blue makeup.
I'm sure didn't help either.
Yeah, because apparently those things, I mean, it always used to amaze me when I used to hear stuff like Babylon 5, where the people who would basically be in the alien outfits, how they used to spend like about like 5 hours, you know, going, you know, putting over like the prosthetics on and everything like that. And it's just, how would you do that? You know, to be doing that virtually, you know, every day before you were sort of, before you'd even started shooting, but you were basically sat doing all that. So I understand that she's sort of like, you know, trying to get out of it, but you know, to me, it doesn't really fit, but whatever. I mean, the good thing is that for next Sunday, I'll have I'll do a non-spoiler review. For the American audience who won't have seen it yet.
That's funny. Yeah, I'm sort of there with you. I'm looking at the Rotten Tomatoes score right now. It's at 59%. It's technically a rotten film. If this film, I wouldn't say even if it goes drastically lower, because if it gets to a certain point, I may want to watch the film for the train wreck aspect. But I think this is the first superhero film that I watched, and I'm going to put my foot down and say I'm not watching. I watched Fantastic Four. I watched Batman vs. Superman. Now, I'll admit, part of the reason why I watched those films and I paid for those films was I wanted the train wreck aspect. I wanted to see just how bad it is. This film, where it's at right now, 59, especially with them choosing to tell an apocalypse story, and that's not always the strongest character to tell a really good story, I think this may be the film where it's just, isn't enough of a reason for me to go to the movie theater. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the trouble is with my taste of films, sometimes I'm so off base. Don't be surprised if I come in next Sunday and I'm saying, oh my God, this film was awesome. It was brilliant. Critics don't know what we're talking about. You know, that is more than possible.
I don't think we're going to get that. I think you're going to say, if you go in there with the lowered expectation, I think you're going to enjoy yourself. In fact, if I did that and I walked into this film and went in with a little bit lower expectations, because the last two X-Men films have been, I wouldn't say fantastic, but I think they're good to great. You know, fairly decent outings. I'd say if I had to give it a grade letter, I'd give it maybe a B, B minus. A decent outing. It's not a Marvel film, but all things considered, it's really good. I think that's part of the reason why people are sort of down this X-Men film as well. It's we've seen Spider-Man now in the proper movie Marvel franchise, And at this point, we're sick of the games. Like, we just want everybody in under one roof. We're sick of the politics. We're sick of the business. Just whatever you studios make nice, give and take and give us what we want. Cause I'm getting kind of sick of these solo films. I mean, obviously this is an X-Men movie, so we're dealing with a team, but still we kind of want them all back together. So I'm getting sick of the pettiness, the squabbling. It's just like, Fox, just do whatever you have to, come to whatever business agreement you have to, so we can get X-Men, the Marvel movie franchise, we can get Fantastic Four, the Marvel movie franchise. That way we can, you know, it kind of feels like, I don't know, like that TV show where there's the two lovers and they can't quite seem to, they keep missing each other, but we know they, and end up.
Oh, like Ross and Rachel.
Right, yeah, like Ross and Rachel. We inevitably want them together. And it's not like a scenario like that where we finally get what we want and we're bored with it. No. In fact, the opposite. We've seen so far Spider-Man, the Marvel franchise, and it's been absolutely fantastic. And if we can get more of that synergy from all these studios deciding to play nice and doing what's good for business and just, you know, putting their pride aside and just, really, as a scenario where they stand the chance to make more money by playing nice and, you know, I guess letting all their, sharing their toys, I guess is the expression I want to use. So, I think that's part of it when you look at some of these reviews. It may be a good film on itself, but I think people are sort of, they have that mindset of, let's stop messing around, everybody, and let's let everybody play together now. Okay. From there, we're going to move to our last news story, the announcement of the Andre the Giant film.
Yeah, I mean, I chose this news story because obviously it gives us a chance to talk a bit of wrestling and things because we're both, like, you know, wrestling fans and stuff. And this one, I think, is really, really interesting because, and we've not, basically this has just been announced that this is in the works. So we've not got any casting or anything out of that, but it's interesting to me how they're basically going to pull this off. Because there was an Andre, years and years ago, there was an Andre.
That's the thing I kept thinking, but I'm like, it wasn't officially documented, biofilm, was it?
No, there was a, I don't think, even know if it actually got made, there was an Andre the Giant film in like post production, and they did some like photographs.
Okay. I'm getting confused then.
Okay. I think they showed some. I remember seeing some photographs of sort of like some like concept things of the guy who was playing it, and they basically, they pretty much basically just chose like a basketball player with a big afro, and he just looked really, really bad, you know. And I don't think the film ever got made, so you know we never saw it, but it just looked bad. I mean, the thing is, To me, I don't think you can basically get like a, you need a good actor for this. And I'll explain why in a moment. But I don't think they should go for just somebody who's like really, really big. I think they need to go with a good actor and sort of build around it. Now, to me, if they can basically get Andy Serkis and basically make him look like a little small gremlin golem character, I don't see why they can't use that same technology to basically, and we saw this in Jungle Book what's the guy's name? Christopher Walken. Mm-hmm. They basically made Christopher Walken into like, his face into like an orangutan. I don't see how they can't basically take something like Andy Serkis and basically put his face into like, you know, a giant basically.
I'm sure they're with you that they can go one or two directions with this film. They could, through smoke and mirrors, like you previously suggested, get a really good actor who, I guess, you know, size aside, looks enough like Andre the Giant to where maybe somewhere someone who looks enough like Andre from the chest up that you can sort of, you know, like I said, smoke and mirrors and creative shots. And, you know, obviously you'd probably hire a stunt double who is sort of comparable to Andre's size. You could kind of get away with. But then my problem with this film would also be Andre the Giant was never really a guy who communicated really well. He always had that gargly voice. Mm. And I barring from you do these soliloquies where you hear the voice in his head, I don't know if you could tell that kind of story. I think if you want to do something like that, I think the weight of the storytelling would have to be a really strong supporting cast. Like if you built like these great characters around Andre, and they were sort of just, you know, they were representing Andre. He would still do all the things he would do in the film, but you had people who were emotionally invested in him to where they could sort of represent him and sort of communicate what he was thinking or just on his behalf. You obviously still have Andre there front and center, but you'd have these people sort of telling the Andre this giant story, or they would communicate with him and they would exude the emotions and do the performances. I don't know. This is a film on paper. It seems like a no brainer, but when you start thinking of the logistics of it, it may be it may be easier said than done.
Yeah. I think you can basically, there is the artistic license. So basically the voice and everything, you could basically just sort of, you know, work around that and basically just like do away with the kind of, just make it a more sort of, a more communicatable voice, basically, and just give him like a strong French accent or something. I think you can basically, you know, you can play around with that. The thing is, there is a good story in there because, and quite a tragic one as well, because of the basically, you know, the disease that he had that basically made him so big. At that time, there was no way he was ever actually going to have a long life. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's, you know, so you've got quite a tragic story there. You've got the story of him basically. This is one of the problems that I have with the story is, I was watching Collider the other day when we were talking about this film. And the problem is that there is so much bullshit stories in wrestling, which are sort of total myths that get basically said so much that they become almost like, you know, accepted as fact. Because on Collider, they were talking about, oh, well, he passed the torch to Hulk Hogan, and Hulk Hogan was really scared because they had this big match and he wasn't sure if Andre was actually going to, you know, do the job for him. And he's saying, you know, and he says the thing about, you know, and then they decided to do a spot where the body slammed him and they just, you know, came out from the blue and everything. And it was like, but the thing is, I understand them. So to like, if you're not a wrestling fan, and when I say a wrestling, not just a wrestling fan, but like, a hardcore wrestling fan like, say, like me and you, where we sort of like, you know, we basically subscribe to The Observer, and we sort of, you know, we can sort of tell what stories are bullshit and what stories are myths and that sort of thing. If you haven't sort of like been in that, you're going to hear these stories because you hear them so often that you believe them. And that you believe it, sort of like Hulk Hogan was the big star, and that Andre was the big star, and that he passed the torch to Hogan when it was ready and all this. And we sort of know that, but other people, and what worries me is that they're going to basically, the film's going to sort of focus on loads and loads of stories like that, mm-hmm. You know? And that's kind of the stuff that I'm sort of like, you know, I kind of want it to be, obviously you're going to get the stuff that sort of, you know, isn't true, but sort of like, you know, in all sort of like, you know, biopics, they'll basically sort of take things and basically, you know, exaggerate them all sort of, you know. But I hope that they basically sort of like, you know, tell the Andre story and not sort of like, you know, cloud it with too much sort of like, you know, bullshit. I mean, there's so many stories though that you kind of want to be true. Because I saw this, I can't remember what, I think it was on the Ultimate Warrior DVD actually. Bobby Heenan told a story of how, him and Ultimate Warrior were doing this series of matches, and each night Ultimate Warrior would hit Andre with a clothesline, and each night it would basically run at him faster and harder and hit him harder and harder. Mm-hmm. And Heenan could tell that basically something was going to happen. And then one night when a Warrior was like running to the, running towards Andre basically just put his fist out. And Warrior, like, you know, walked straight into it and basically sort of fell back. And then, the night after that, he came and did the clothesline, and he did it a lot softer. And apparently, Andre said to Heenan afterwards, like, you know, he's learning. You know? And it's one of these stories that itself could be a bullshit story, but it sounds so good that you kind of, you know, you want it to, you know, I would like to see that in there as a good comedy thing. But, you know, but with wrestling, you don't know what's myth and what's not. But I just kind of, I want like a true Andre story, because I think there is, you know, one, you know, a good one there. And the fact that so many people, like the people who were working with him on The Princess Bride, said that he was such, like, you know, such a gentle person. you know, in the, you know, in real life and everything. So I'm sort of looking forward to it, but I hope they kind of sort of play straight as what you can do with fats in a wrestling thing. I mean, Andre the Giant, I've got to admit, when I started watching wrestling, it was when he's sort of like, he basically was, his career was pretty much coming to the end. He was started to become more immobile, and he was basically, his matches, he was basically pretty much just doing like tag matches where he just tagging for like a short amount of time, or he'd do these like really short matches where he didn't do a lot. But, you know, if you have it sort of see the stuff that he did, you know, he's, in Japan in the early 80s when he was sort of like, you know, athletically still at prime, he was still huge, but he was also so fast as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for if you watch some of those things, and agile, I mean, I heard these stories how he would do drop kicks and stuff, and I think, oh, that's, you know, they would come off the top rope and stuff. We have to watch it. He did, you know, do those things. They weren't the most crispiest of sort of like wrestling, you know, maneuvers that he did, but he was like, you know, a big athlete. And when you see him, he, you know, sort of like, you know, running around the ring and chasing people. So, you know, he was, you know, a hell of an athlete.
Yeah, all things considered, like you said, with his weight and his size, yeah, he was. You discount that gap, and obviously give him the benefit of the doubt with that. Yeah, all things considered, yeah, he was a fairly decent athlete. My only question is, I thought you were bringing it up earlier. There was that film with Billy Crystal, Mike Giant. Wasn't that supposed to be a loosely based story on Andre the Giant, or am I just imagining that?
I've not heard of that film.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
Oh, okay, well, I wouldn't recommend going out of your way, but
okay,
it's a film very similar to an Andre the Giant story. I feel like they wanted to tell an Andre the Giant story, and I guess for the reason why either the Andre people or whoever, I guess who you would say owns the rights to his estate, probably put the kibosh on it. But it was like one of those things to where they made so much of the film already, they just decided to go all out with it. It's a film that if you want to pretend it's about Andre the Giant, it is, because it's enough. They base enough off it to where you can kind of extrapolate that maybe it is an Andre the Giant story.
Okay. But I'm just looking up it up now, and it's not the one I was thinking of, but it says it's Billy Crystal made it inspired by Andre the Giant.
There you go.
Because he basically met, obviously Billy Crystal was in The Princess Bride and he met Andre the Giant. And so he basically, that the film was basically inspired by him meeting Andre the Giant. So it was kind of, it wasn't about Andre the Giant, but yeah, you're right. It could be, you know, it's kind of like an inspiration for it.
Yeah, you watched the film and I just assumed it was an Andre the Giant biopic. Right. But there's enough in there to where, you know, if they wanted to go after the studio behind making this, that they made it an Andre the Giant film. They made it different enough to where they can get away with it. But you can watch it and there's clearly stuff with him obviously doing pro wrestling. And he's obviously from the, I don't know if he's from France in this movie, but it's enough of a film where it's very obvious that they're telling this Andre the Giant story. And the guy who's the Andre character, obviously he's not out there to put on a great performance. It's really Billy Crystal who's an advocate of, I guess, the Andre the Giant character. So who sort of is, like I said, he's an advocate. So everything that you expect Andre to say and do and want, he's sort of there to represent Andre.
Yeah, I've actually just pulled up a photo of him. He's actually Romanian. He was a basketball player, and I cannot pronounce that name. I'll ever give it a go. George Morrison. Mm-hmm. And I've just pulled a photo of him, and he does actually look like he's got the Andre the Giant features.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the giganticism features. So yeah, when I looked at him, he does. Yeah, I think obviously you're right. He's basically sort of like, you know, there to sort of portray, you know, a version of Andre the Giant. But yeah, the photograph, he has got that Andre look about him. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's one of those things to where if you look at the scores of the movie, it's a particularly pan movie. It's not good. So I imagine if you're choosing to make a biopic, a serious biopic on the life of Andre the Giant, it would have to be better than this. Because this was sort of tongue-in-cheek. Obviously, you put Billy Crystal in there, so it's, you know, it's going to be a comedy film. And there was some stuff with his fading health, but really, the crux of the film was really just kind of a wacky buddy comedy, with Billy Crystal just being the bombastic character, and he wasn't Andre, but the Andre character was sort of just the straight man. So he could just play off of Billy.
Just now, now we've mentioned it, by the way, if anyone's never seen The Princess Bride,
First of all, shame on you, and then pause this podcast and watch the entire film, and you can go back to listen to our show now.
Welcome back, and I'm sure you enjoyed that. that is an awesome film.
I dare say the idea of someone not seeing The Princess Bride is inconceivable.
Also, it's got one of the most amazing sword fights ever.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is a film you need. What's great about it as well is it is a film that you can sort of like, you know, watch with. It's kind of like a family film, but there's loads and loads of funny stuff in there that adults get as well. Mm-hmm. You know, but Andre is like, you know, just even though he's got the garbled voice and everything, his character is so endearing. It's like, you know, but yeah, that's a hell of a film.
Yeah, and if you haven't already, by all means, do yourself a favor and watch that film. Although I can't imagine who's listening to us. I can't imagine most of our average listener would probably be a person who has watched a film like that before.
Yeah.
I like to think highly of our listeners.
Yeah.
All right. That's going to do it for this week's news. From here, we're going to do our usual segment of the top films of 1976. Let's go. At number 10, we have Silent Movie. Number 9, Midway. Number 8, The Enforcer. Number 7, Silver Streak. Number 6, King Kong. King Kong, Dazza. King Kong. The 1976 remake. Number 5, In Search of Noah's Ark. I didn't even know that was a film. Number 4, The Omen. Number 3, All President's Men. Number 2, To Fly. And at number 1, any guess as of what it could be, just off the top of your head?
Oh, God. I have no idea.
It would be the 1976 classic, Rocky! Now, for those of you who are probably who may be listening to the show for the first time, but you're wondering, why do we do that? This is a segment that we do every week on our show where it's called Rate and Slate, and we'll pick the best film of the top 10 films of a given year. So we started this from, I think it was TOKO90.com, where we started at 1970, and we've worked our way up, and so far, as of right now, we are in 1976. So, like I said, right now, we did the top 10 films. We're going to do our favorite and the one that we hate the most. Now Dazza has come up with the expression rate or slate. So, Dazza, what is going to be your is it rate? Yeah, it's been so many times that we've done this. It's rate, right?
Yes, yeah. The one that I'm going to pick is, before I go into it, a couple of films on there, which were really weird entries. I mean, the Search for Noah's Ark one, which was a documentary, is a strange one. But one I had to look up was the number, I think it was number 2, the To Fly.
To Fly, yeah. That is kind of a weird film. Most of these films, I mean, some of them I've obviously heard of, I've never watched. I haven't watched a lot. I could tell, right, full disclosure right now, I haven't seen most of these films. Some of them I haven't even heard of.
Yeah, so, I mean, To Fly was actually, I had to look this up, and I believe why it was such a big film is that it was actually it was a short documentary, a short film, but it was sort of, I think it was one of the first films that was done like in the IMAX format.
Ah, okay.
So it was more like a spectacle. It was basically like the history of flight, but it was more like a spectacle that you would go and see, almost like, you know, like the 3D type thing. So I think that's why that was such a big film. But yeah, the Search for Noah's Ark one, I'd not heard of till I saw this list. It sounds like it was basically it was documentary that basically pretty much was about there's this mountain region somewhere where they actually have claims that they have found evidence that this is actually a resting area of the original Noah's Ark. Mm-hmm. The problem is this documentary apparently sort of it basically sort of did it from the point of view that this is what it is. You know, so it was quite biased in its sort of portrayal of basically that this area is basically the, you know, the Noah's Ark, you know, but that's what that film is all about. The one that I am going to pick, and this was a tough one because there's a couple of my favorites here, but the one I'm actually going to pick, is going to be All the President's Men.
Ooh, I'm surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet you thought I was going to pick Rocky, didn't you?
Yeah, because that's what I'm going to go with right now. That's my pick right from the get-go. I mean,
yeah.
This is kind of a no-brainer. I mean, I'm honestly shocked considering, you know, we're hosted on an MMA site. We, you know, obviously, it's boxing, so it's not a fair comparison. It's not a one-to-one comparison. But really, I'm shocked you didn't pick Rocky.
Yeah. The thing is, all I will say on that is that they are more than one Rocky film. To pick, shall we say. So,
I was going to say, are you just being a contrarian and you expected, you know, I expected you to pick Rocky, so you decided to go the other way and pick something else, or is that?
No, it's just that I think it's like, because when I pick these films, I'm not necessarily picking what I think is the best film. It's kind of just what one film that I'm going to pick as the one which I really, really, you know, like and adhere to. It's like when we get to, eventually we'll get to Star Wars, I probably won't pick, you know, more than one Star Wars film, shall we say. You know, so I'll probably pick just one Star Wars film and I can sort of, like, you know, spread the love on other movies. But with it, so maybe there might be a Rocky film that comes up, which will actually be my rate. But you know, All the President's Men is the one that I'm going to pick. Absolutely. It's one of those films that it's just sort of absolutely gripping film. It was really great to me because the whole Watergate thing was, you know, well before my time. Mm-hmm. And seeing a film like this, but just put everything into sort of like, you know, into like a narrative and a concept, what was great. I think the performances, absolutely, you know, astounding in there, you know, Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman. And what I like about it is it's quite understated. It doesn't try to sort of turn this into like a John Grisham type thing where you've got basically someone like sort of although there is a threat in this film where the government there's like this shadowy figure trying to sort of like, you know, like, you know, close down the investigation, but they're doing this journalistic piece. It's not as if they're basically being like chased down, like sort of, basically like by gunmen or anything like that. It's basically played very sort of, you know, low key and everything. It's pretty much as it was done, but it's still like just this like gripping, absolutely, you know, amazing, you know, storyline, and it's just a film that I watched this sort of very young, and it was a film that when I saw it, I didn't really understand what it was about because I was sort of too young to comprehend the whole thing about politics and sort of, you know, and Nixon and everything like that. But it was just something that I could tell it was a good film just by the performances and by the shots. I mean, there's this like wonderful shot where the two of them are in a library and they're going through all these sort of like these records on the case. And as they're on the table, there's like the camera just sort of pans upwards and out. It's just this sort of like metaphor for them sort of that they're in this, investigation, and that as they're sort of like investigating, that everything's opening up to them. It's just these little sort of like, you know, really well done, like, you know, cinema tricks that they do. But yeah, it is, you know, one of my favorite films of all time, and just a wonderful film. So that's why I pretty much picked this one.
Okay. And obviously my pick was Rocky because it's an absolute classic. I can't think of anything better, Dazza. All right. Now I'm curious now. Let's move on to our next segment. Slate. Now what are you going to pick for Slate on this?
Okay, right. Well, this was easy. This was absolutely easy because this film I'm going to pick, it was one of the first films. I've tried to remember what the first films were that I went to the cinema as a kid was. And this was one of the first ones. I don't know if it was the first one, but I do remember seeing it. I remember seeing it and having a lot of patience as a really kid. Cause what year is this?
1976.
Okay. So if you take a year, leave a year for it to get to the UK, I'd probably be about 5 when I saw this film. And I had to have a lot of patience in this film. And it's the remake of King Kong.
I'm right there with you. I haven't seen, full disclosure, I haven't seen the film, but I've seen highlights and I've seen people talk about the film. And this is a film that obviously that they're remaking. I had probably had to investigate this. When was the original, I almost said Donkey Kong.
I think it was it about 29?
And that's a classic for them to go and make this poor entry in the franchise. Now, obviously, they would try later on down the road with Peter Jackson, and that's still, while not a terrible outing, it still wasn't great. To me, it's one of these films to where they should just stop trying to remake it.
1933.
Yeah, 1933.
So it was between the two wars.
Yeah, when everyone thinks of King Kong, that's the film everyone thinks of, the 1933 film. I've seen enough of the 1976 film to where I'm right there with you. This is going to be my slight. It's a terrible movie. It's one of these things to where obviously they have the technology to do better effects, but they don't have the storytelling ability to do the smoke and mirrors to make it look. It's one of those things where it's a classic and you shouldn't try to do a retelling of the story because it was perfect the way it was.
Yeah. I mean, the original King Kong was I think it must have been one of the first films I ever saw as a kid. And it was this, it was one of those films that whenever it was on TV, because this is before video and stuff, I would always watch it. Absolutely loved that film. I mean, it had dinosaurs in it and everything. And actually, there's one thing I will disagree with you about this when you said that the newer film had better special effects. I don't think it did, because the original, it was all stop motion. Mm-hmm. But it was absolutely amazing stop motion. I mean, they managed to make, I mean, I have to say one thing as well, for it to be, this film to be made in the 30s, the absolute, you know, the breadth of their vision for this film is absolutely amazing, because they basically had this set on like an island of dinosaurs, and there is like King Kong there and he's fighting with dinosaurs, but there's also the crew also get into scraps with dinosaurs, and then you have the sort of him going on the rampage through New York and climbing the Empire State Building, and then the planes and everything for them to actually, you know, and they say stop motion, but it's just such amazingly done. And what they managed to do as well is they made King Kong this really sympathetic figure. Because there's this like sort of, you know, when he's sort of being shot and his eyebrows sort of like go down and he's looking all sad and everything, it's heartbreaking. In this newer one, this 70s piece of shit that they made, it's basically going back to a guy being in a costume.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And there's one scene where they made a big thing that they were actually having a life-size King Kong. And there's one scene where they have the big, massive life-size King Kong and it doesn't do anything. It's just sort of almost like it's like slowly walking. It's just like really, really, you know, horrible. And the film is so boring and long and slow paced. I mean, the thing about the original King Kong is it is really, really fast paced. You know, it doesn't take them long to get to the island. They meet Kong pretty much early on. He gets into lots of, you know, basically when he's got Fay Wray, there's basically lots of fights. I mean, I think there's about five different creatures that he fights. In the original King Kong. I mean, when he fights with Tyrannosaurus Rex and he hits him with like the LA type, you know, punch where he sort of squares it back. It's wonderful. And I remember as a kid being really disappointed that there was like one fight scene in this new one. And it's where he fights a giant snake. But the film, it takes ages to get to the island because it's sort of, you know, because it's sort of like a more modern take, they feel they have to basically give it more like sort of dialogue and more pace and stuff. It takes ages to get to the island. It's, you know, there's a long scene where they're transporting Kong between the island back to New York. It doesn't climb the Empire State Building, it climbs the Twin Towers, which obviously, I'm fine with that because, like, you know, that's what you would climb in New York. But it takes him ages to get up the thing. It's just a really slow, plodding film. You know, the King Kong in it. One thing I'll say, I mean, I actually quite like the Peter Jackson King Kong. I didn't like it as much as the original. But one thing they did manage to do is they made Kong, again, sort of like a sympathetic figure. You know, we've sort of, you know, he's, and they made him sort of like he humanized him somewhat. In this King Kong, you know, there's just absolutely nothing in there. I absolutely hated it. I do remember as a kid, just sort of, I was a really patient kid, you know, when it came to films. I would sort of sit through films that I probably shouldn't have been sitting at such a young age. But I remember being in a cinema, I think asking my mum when King Kong was going to come along. And me and my kid having to explain it. Oh, he's going to be coming. We're just going on to the island. We're going to find him and everything, like, you know. And it's just, it's a lousy film, but it's just really horrible. I mean, the original's wonderful. You know, that's the film. I realize that maybe people don't watch it these days because it's in black and white and everything. It's, you know, and everything. And some of the effects are sort of quite dated, but it is a wonderful film, the original.
Yeah. So
you know what scene I always and it's a scene because the thing about the original as well is that they don't sugarcoat is that basically Kong is basically when he's on the loose he is killing people, you know he basically the train smashes into him and obviously all those people are dead and stuff and then he's sort of like it doesn't sort of sugarcoat that. There's one scene where he's basically looking for Fay Wray. And he's climbing the tower, the Empire State Building. And he's looking through the windows and he sees this like blonde lady in one of the hotel rooms. Mm-hmm. So he puts his fist through and sort of grabs the lady and brings her out because he thinks it's Fay Wray. And then he takes a sort of close look at her and he realizes it's not. So then he just drops her. But in his sort of innocent mind, he's not doing it to, he's just basically, oh, it's not her, and just drops her from this thing. I don't know why, but I always find that hysterical. And I shouldn't. It's an awful thing. But, you know, I always find it really funny.
Yeah, I'm looking at the film right now, the scenes. Obviously, the one I think of when most people think of this remake. And obviously, this was just purely a cash grab. They realized there was enough cachet and the King Kong name, they can make a subpar film and probably make obviously they made a lot of money, but I'm looking at the scene where obviously he's caged up and he's got the crown on and just like, it's so obvious it's a guy in a suit.
Yeah. It's Dino Laurinaitis as well, who was, I think produced it. So, and he's kind of a bit of a sort of, most of the stuff that he touches was basically pretty much crap.
Yeah, by doing a Google image search, now obviously most of the images here are obviously of the 1976 film that they were just bringing up, but a couple of these pictures are actually pictures of the 1973 one, and who would think compared to the three movies, and now I forget what year the new Peter Jackson one came out in, 2005, there we go. There's this one image where they have the three of them compared back to back to back. And if you would have told me the 1933 one would be the best of the three, I would have called you a liar, but I'm here. I'm looking at it with my own two eyes and the 1933 one. It's not only more scarier of the three, it's also the most realistic. If you could believe that.
And for its time as well, because the Peter Jackson one, the special effects were already there. CGI is pretty much at the stage now where it's pretty much, you know, if you've got the money and everything to do it properly, all the technology is already there. Whereas as back in the, you know, in the 30s, you know, that, what they had to do to make that film, you know, that took a hell of a lot of vision and a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the King Kong scenes. Like, you know, there's loads of scenes, like, say, with dinosaurs. It's like, I remember there's like a Stegosaurus scene. There's a bit where they sort of, the sailors are fighting, I think, like a Brontosaurus or something. There's just so much great stuff, you know, in there. I'm doing what you're doing. I just had a look at some of the footage, some of the pictures from it. It's even worse than I remembered. Because it's one of these films that I've not rewatched for a long time. It's kind of, I think I watched it, obviously went to the cinema, and I might have watched it once since and thought, oh God, this is awful. But I'm just looking at the, God, it's even worse.
Yeah.
This is just absolutely, you know, it's absolutely, yeah, this is, of all the times, sometimes you sort of, you feel bad about, sort of, yeah, the thing with the crown, I'm just looking at that one.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where, Some of these years, you're kind of sort of struggling to like pick one, which is really bad. When I saw this was on the list, this was like, yeah, that's going in. I have absolutely no reservations. This is a piece of shit film.
All right. From there, we're going to start wrapping this segment up. Daza, have you been watching any particular films of late?
Oh, what was the Oscar one?
Oh, the Oscar. Thank you for bringing that up. Now, it kind of would be a no-brainer. I can kind of do this without even looking. It was obviously Rocky.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, for those of you who are wondering how we pick Best Picture, it's Best Picture for 1970, 1977. Now, obviously, we talked films 1976, but the way the Academy works is always the year after. So this is not us doing a, you know, us messing up just the way the best picture for films is done. Okay, sorry about that, guys.
I have to say as well that even though it wasn't my first pick, I do absolutely love Rocky as a movie. I think it's awesome.
Okay. From there, we're going to move on. Sorry, I didn't mean to get ahead of myself there. As long as we're talking films, have you been watching anything as of late in particular? Any, doesn't have to be contemporary films, but just what have you been watching as of late?
A few films, just really quickly, because I pretty much got a couple of weeks worth of, I saw Bastille Day, which was I have trouble pronouncing this, Idris Elba, almost doing like a James Bond thing. It was okay, you know, decent action film, but it was one that I walked away. It was kind of just like a, oh yeah, that was okay type movie. It seemed to be like him sort of, you know, because we're mentioning maybe doing James Bond. It seemed almost like a dress rehearsal at times. But even had like a scene where he's like doing a chase scene over the rooftops and stuff, a bit like in Casino Royale. But it was okay. It wasn't anything special. But a couple of films. Oh, I've got to mention this one. On Netflix, I saw a documentary on Twisted Sister.
Ooh, nice. should we go over our exchange that we had online on Facebook?
Well, you'll have to remind me.
Okay, let's. And I love this. Okay. Did they take it?
No, they ain't going to take it.
No, I remember your exact quotation was, not anymore.
Oh, great. I'm going to take it. Yeah. Okay. You talk about a week ago, you know.
But that was so funny. I felt the need to repost it. I'm like, yeah. Me and Daz are so funny. He's like, I just watched the Sister documentary, and I was like, oh, do they take it? And you very quickly, with you know, within a minute, you're like, not anymore.
Yeah, it was real weird though, because I mean, what I really enjoyed about this film is it was pretty much everything up to the point where they actually became a success. So it pretty much ended with them basically getting their first record deal. It was mainly about them sort of going through the small gig scene in the '70s in New York and sort of getting like, so it was basically almost a story of what it was like for bands at that time trying to get established and everything and getting gigs and stuff like that. And it was just like a really you know, for me, I found it really fascinating. I have a real soft spot for these biopics anyway, when we're talking to bands, but it was at a time where rock music was kind of, it was basically disco was the big thing. Mm-hmm. So for rock music, it was kind of, was like a sort of like, almost like a niche, underground. It was kind of moved on from the punk scene, but it was still that sort of like, a more sort of like, rebellious underground feel to it. And they had actually lots of footage from some of their, like, you know, concerts and everything. And there was basically nothing like them around it, although it was Alice Cooper. Dee Snider, when he came out, it was basically sort of just, you know, absolutely, you know, it's when you see him later, but when they became a success and the outfits he was playing, there was almost like a sort of like a playfulness to his sort of like, you know, almost like a pantomime aspect to them. But before that, when he was basically pretty much just like him, almost in drag and stuff like that, he just looked so bizarre. You know, but it was like, for me, an interesting documentary of that time. And then what it was like, you know, on the scene. And like I say, it was weird because it was like 2 hours, which just, you know, went by and they never even got to like sort of the, I Wanna Rock or We're Not Gonna Take It Anymore. It didn't even touch on that except for a brief little thing about it right at the end. But it was basically all about them sort of going through the festival circuit and everything, getting a record deal and all the band members they went through and all the drugs and everything like that. So it was just like it's on Netflix UK. So I'm pretty sure it's on Netflix US. As well, I think the full title is something of the lines of it's Twisted Fucking Sister. That's the title of the documentary. But it was a real good documentary if you sort of like music of any kind.
It's We're Twisted Effing Sister. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Film wise, I went to see a a couple of films this week. I went to see Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, which I actually quite liked as a film. It's a film with Tina Fey, and it's basically based on a true story about a woman who was a journalist in Afghanistan. And rather strangely, it takes a, although it deals with the subject seriously, it's based on a, one woman's sort of story, a woman called Kim Barker, and her sort of book that she wrote about being in there. There's a lot of comedy in there as well, which you wouldn't expect. And it's been a box office bomb. Cause it's only just come out of the UK, but it's released in America quite a while ago. And it's been a bomb. It's made 23 million and it had a 35 million budget. So it's been a box office bomb. And reviews have kind of not been, kind to it, but I actually quite enjoyed it as a movie. I found, there's a lot of good scenes, which were, funny in it and stuff like that. And it was just sort of, it was like an easygoing, fun film, but sort of, serious. It actually did deal with the sort of, the seriousness of being a journalist in those situations. But it was also about sort of like, the wackiness that goes on, how the journalists actually sort of like, let their hair down and stuff to actually cope with being in a situation which is like, really, really dangerous and stuff like that. And, so I really enjoyed that one. Another film I saw on the same day, which is a hell of a lot darker, is a film called Green Room. Ooh. And this is a small, I presume it's a small independent film. It's basically it's a thriller about a small punk band who basically do a gig in neo-Nazi bar. And they basically discover something they're not meant to see, and which basically means that they end up in a standoff with this skinhead group. And what made this film like really, really good for me was Patrick Stewart's in it, and he plays the head of the skinhead group. He's like their sort of like their mentor and everything. And I've never actually seen him play a villain before. He is absolutely terrifying because he's got the Patrick Stewart sort of polite. Although he plays American, he's got that sort of like politeness about him, that sort of like mild mannered, sort of like easygoing thing, but with this like chilling, violent intentions. And the film is really, really violent. And I don't mean quite sort of like going out like so violent. I just mean like sort of like really uncompromising, uncomfortable, it's like really, really tense, it's really tense standoff and stuff. And I thought it was a really great film, but it's also one that you've got to kind of, it's not for everybody. If you don't like stuff sort of like really tense and really violent, and if you don't like dogs, which I have to admit, I kind of have a little phobia about certain dogs, it's not for you. But it's a really, really good film, but like really dark and grim as well.
Okay. And, have you been reading any books as of late? I know we sort of talked about this off air. I'm curious what book this actually was.
Yeah, basically this is, I need to give a shout out to a gentleman by the name of David Owen. Cause, a few weeks back, I wrote my Grand National piece for Half Guarded. And we mentioned this on one of the shows as well. And he actually, got in touch with me on Twitter cause he read my article and he basically suggested a book of his for me to read. And this is actually a book that, I've actually, believe it or not, did mean to read before. Basically, because I've said this before, I work in a bookshop, and one of the sections I look after is like the sports section. So, unfortunately, being working a bookshop is that you basically every single day you see books come in that you want to read, and a lot of them you don't basically get round to reading because there's just so many. I do remember his book, and I've actually bought it and read since, because I wanted to read it at the time and never got around to it. The book's called Foinaven, and it's actually a book about a horse in the Grand National. And if you've read the article, I actually did a little piece about him. If you read my article on the Grand National, you'll see that I actually mentioned Foinaven, because he's basically like one of the great underdog stories in sport. Because what happened is he was in the Grand National, which is basically the horse race over jumps that we have every year in the UK, which is a big, massive deal. Fournier was basically, he was sort of like a decent horse, but he was basically like an underachiever. He would win the odd race and stuff, but he was never going to, it was basically just that he didn't have the temperament to have that killer instinct to win races. It was basically just sort of like an also ran. And he, one year he qualified to get into the Grand National, and he was basically right at the back of the field with about a quarter of the race to go. What happened is that the, one of the smaller fences in the Grand National, a fence which has since been renamed the Foinaven fence, mm-hmm. Basically two loose horses, came to a fence and ran across the leading pack and basically got in their way, and they basically crashed into the fence, and then the horses behind them sort of crashed into them, and it basically just became one massive pile up. And basically pretty much every single horse in the race basically sort of fell, either fell at the fence or basically got impeded on the run to this. And the whole thing was absolute chaos. It was basically, horses were going, you know, left, right and center in all different directions. Jockeys were chasing, falling off the horse, was chasing after the horse, trying to get back on and everything. And then right for all these horses, it's all just like this mad carnage. Right from the back, Foinaven just managed to see, to basically come, when he came to come to the fence, there was just a big enough gap for him to jump over the fence. And he basically pretty much like limps over it because he was quite tired at this point. Mm-hmm. And he basically went on to win the race. And it was just like one of the big, massive upsets in sport. It was the sort of thing that really shouldn't have happened, but just shows you what in sport, you know, can happen. And he's basically wrote a book basically about the life of Foinaven. And it's a really interesting book because it basically takes you through being, it's a bit like, it reminds me of another really great book I've read called Seabiscuit.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically sort of takes you through the life of basically like a racehorse. So it's basically about how the horses are bred and everything, and then how they're trained and how they're sort of like, you know, raced and everything. And Foinaven was basically, like I say, he was one of these racehorses that, a lot of what makes the winners in horse racing isn't just the sort of like the physical attributes, it's also the mental and the personality. Because you can basically train a horse so much, but if it's got the wrong personality, you can't basically make it, you know, you can't turn it into a winner just by training it. And Foinaven just was kind of like a lazy horse. He would sort of like just do enough to sort of to race, but would never sort of like, you know, go to his like, you know, top level to win. And he was sort of basically, like I said, just like an everyman horse race, but just happened to have his one day. And when he had his one day, it was on the biggest horse race, you know, in the world. And it's just like a real interesting book. And it's sort of how the sort of the race went down, how it affected the, you know, them afterwards and everything. And it's just, you know, for me, I just found it a fascinating story. I also felt a bit of a kinship with the author, David Owen, because if you read my piece, you'll see that I was basically obsessed with the Grand National at a very early age. I used to do my own basically comic strips. I used to make up my own race and everything. And then after the Grand National, I'd basically recreate the race in sort of like, you know, just drawing like the pictures of each fence and everything. And he basically was the same. He basically going in, he saw it when he was very, very young and got obsessed with it. And he would basically make his own races. He used to basically get these, I guess what you'll call them, trading cards.
Mm-hmm.
He would have them all over Grand National, and he would create his own little races as a kid. And so it was reading the stuff that he would do, it was kind of the stuff that I would do as well, you know. So I just kind of got a kick out of it. But if you like sport books of any kind, even, you know, because I'm, apart from the Grand National, I'm not the biggest horse racing fan in the world, but I read this book and was absolutely, you know, really gripped by it. It's just like a really, really, you know, good story.
Okay. So what's the name of this book again?
It's Foinaven.
Okay.
It's by David Owen. So if you put a link in the article, so other people can see it. But yeah, you know, but yeah, it's,
even right now I'm sort of struggling because, you know, I'm obviously hear you say it, but I don't know how the spelling of that actually goes. So you're gonna have to just give me that later.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll sort that out for you.
Okay. All right, and from there, have you been writing any articles as of late that people should check out?
There was the two Invicta pieces that I did. I always do a preview for Invicta, and then I do a review afterwards of the show. So I did buy Invicta ones if people want to read that. Invicta Fighting Championship, which is the all-women's promotion. I did my pieces on that. So, they're up there. Well, on the last show, we kind of teased I was doing, I was about to release the weirdest children's TV in the UK, which has since gone up. And I've actually had quite a few, some good feedback about that. Quite a few, because I always post it on my Facebook wall and on my Twitter and stuff like that. And quite a few people who don't normally read my articles were intrigued by this one and read it and sort of, you know, liked it. So it's kind of, and I think I'm going to have to do another one of these at some point, because people sort of read it, particularly people in the UK, and then would get in touch with me and would be saying, what about so and so, or this, you know, and all these others that I forget. I mean, afterwards, how I actually forgot Emu, which there was a character called Emu, who was basically with a guy called I think it's Roy Hull, and there was basically Roy Hull and Emu, and he basically just would he would bring this puppy Emu on to talk shows and stuff. It gets better. Because this puppet was one where he basically had his hand in it, and basically his hand was basically working the mouth and everything. So it was pretty much like a glorified glove puppet. Wow. But what he used to do, he would basically sort of use the email to attack guests and stuff. So he'd be going to these talk shows and stuff, and he would basically just sort of like have email basically sort of like assault the talk show host and stuff that. So I'm going to have to do another one, because there's so many people sort of like reminding me of other shows that I'm probably going to have to do a part two to this. So there will be more sort of nightmarish UK stuff to come.
Oh God.
But the one that I'm working on at the moment, which, and is quite timely because of what we've been talking about, I'm actually doing my, finally my Civil War piece, which is basically going to be on the Civil War comic.
I was wondering, I'm like, we talked at length the film, and I can't imagine you have a article concerning the film, so I can imagine what this is covering. So this is going to be covering the original comic book event series that happened, I believe,
Which, and it's actually, I didn't realize, it's actually 10 years. It was 2006.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of like the 10-year anniversary. So, you know, so I thought it was sort of, it was far enough away of it to do an actual, like a timely look at it. And I've sort of been rereading the comics and the spin-offs and stuff like that just to remind me. And let's just say I've got a lot to say about it. good and bad.
Okay, because perfect. Go ahead.
Yeah, because there was sort of, I mean, one thing I have to say about it is that Civil War helped me to get back into comics. You know, because it was sort of like an event that basically came along that sort of intrigued me, and it sort of brought me back into the fold. So I'll be talking about that, but also I'll be talking about, you know, the time that sort of like influenced it, you know, what was going on in the time, and also how it sort of, you know, worked as a series, what did work and what didn't work. But I mean, the thing is that the, you know, for all its faults and everything, I do think it changed quite a lot in comics, basically. I think, you know, it caught a lot of people's imagination, and, you know, and it's still, even today, it is one of the largest selling, you know, the actual series graphic novel. It is one of the largest selling graphic novels, and it still sells to this day. You know, it sort of has more, I think, lasting appeal than say, you know, stuff like, Siege or House of M or any of those kind. It's something that basically caught imagination. So I'm going to be looking at the good and the bad in there.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad you're choosing to write the article around the good and bad, because really, in wake of the movie, I've seen nothing but people pining how great it was, how, you know, it was one of the most influential, best stories, and I'm like, I'm not there. And aside from like maybe our show, Comic Conversations, my other show, Comic Conversations, nobody really else delves into the negativity of Civil War. And I kind of feel with you, Dazza, you were kind of get kind of a fair assessment of the event, all the good, all the bad. So it's kind of nice we're going to get that from somebody, because up until now, people are kind of hesitant to be critical of the comic event with the success of the movie. And I guess, you know, especially with people who want to, you know, move paper and whatnot, or get people to read their articles, they'll probably lean towards being, you know, they'll put on kid gloves and they'll be, oh, it's so great, and we're so great. Read our article about Civil War, and then go around and buy the graphic novel. So I'm sort of glad you're willing to go out there and be sort of, you know, take the good and the bad. You're willing to accept it for what it is.
Yeah, I have to say as well, and this will come up in the article. I think there's two different experiences you get with a lot of big events. I think you get the experiences if you're reading the comics at the time as they come out, you know, as a monthly or weekly, you know, type series with all these spin-offs and everything. It's a very different experience from when you then read it, like, in full as a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, so I think I'll be sort of like delving into that a little bit, because I think it was sort of like a but there's a lot to go into, but it was a very different experience from any other sort of spin-off, from any other big event that had come up by this point. It is what I'm sort of, you know, rereading it and sort of like, you know, comparing it to the stuff that had come before and that sort of thing. So I think it was pretty big and pretty influential, but there's a lot of things that sort of I said about it that I agree with and a lot that I disagree with. And I do think it's one that sort of, you know, it dropped the ball on certain things, but I think, it, you know, there was a lot of good stuff in there. But I think looking back at it 10 years, I think this is like enough time to sort of basically look up and give it sort of like a fair retrospective, shall we say.
Okay, cool. I'm very much looking forward to that article. And if it isn't already on halfguard.com, I'll be sure to link to that when it finally comes out.
Yeah, it won't be for a while because I'm still writing it. And basically, this is one I really want to get right. And it may even be sort of like not up until we do the next show. But it basically, you know, it's one I'm working on, and I'm basically putting everything on hold. Until I've got this one sourced.
Okay, so that's something to keep your eye out for on halfguard.com. That's an article on Civil War. I'm very much looking forward to this article. I tend to be excited for just about everything you write. So, but this more than anything, I'm curious to see where you fall as far as, and sort of akin to the Civil War. What side are you on? The side that's sort of apologetic as far as, you know, it's great. I you know, it has no flaws, and it's one of the great stories ever, or it's sort of, you know, where you're sort of maybe overly critical of it, and you're like, it's terrible, it's awful, it's all these, it's this story that they felt the need to kind of capture what was going on in the American culture, and sort of it was just this Mark Miller story where he's telling a specific story and everyone's kind of out of character. And so I'm curious to see where you fall.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's going to do it for this week's show. So from all of us at halfguard.com, thanks for checking out this week's show. And as always, see you guys next week. Adios.
Bye.